another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Valiant Sunday episode, and today we're going to be talking about Harbinger Wars number 2, both the first issue, the prelude that leads into the main event, and Harbinger Wars 2 number 1. And lucky enough to have Jesse join me again, our resident Valiant expert. So welcome back to the show, Jesse.
Hey, wonderful to be here, Jace. Love it.
Yeah, it's been a while, so it's great to have you back.
Yeah, been on the road for a while, doing a lot of cities, and, it's good to be home.
Great. I appreciate all that you do. You know, with the recent Memorial Day, you were on my mind, so appreciate your service.
No, I appreciate it, man. Appreciate having a country to take care of.
All right, well, let's dive into Harbinger Wars 2, and let's give our overall impressions of the event so far. What'd you think of the first two issues?
To be honest, I like them both. I like both issues, but you can definitely tell that there's a different style, a different tone, both artistically and writing, which makes sense because you have two different art teams. The prelude felt like a continuation of secret weapons, for obvious reasons, and of course, Harbinger Wars 2, issue 1 has a very different feel to it, very different look to it. Which we can get into, but they certainly are quality, and I'm certainly entertained by both of them, and I'm anxiously looking forward to seeing how this all plays out.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. Like, part of me wants to, if I had to sum it up in one word, I'd say disappointment. But here's the thing, right? It's like, if I didn't know the original plan of Valiant for the story, which we'll get into in a second, then maybe I wouldn't be disappointed if I could just enjoy this story and these two issues for what they were. Now, I agree with you. The tone and the look of the two issues is so different. Let me give the creative teams and listeners will kind of understand. So Jesse mentioned that the prelude very much felt like a continuation of Secret Weapons. Well, that's because it's the exact same creative team that we saw in that 4-issue miniseries and those couple of 0 issues. So we have Eric Heiser handling the writing duties, and we have Raoul Allen and Patricia Martin on art. So again, exact same creative team as Secret Weapons, which we've talked about on the podcast before. We did a spotlight on it. To a man, we loved it. We thought it was incredible. We thought it was a big get for Valiant to have Eric Heiser, who wrote Arrival, some of you may not be aware of, nominated for an Academy Award. So clearly a talented writer. When you flip over to Harbinger Wars 2, issue 1, you've got writer Matt Kent, which, no slouch, and art by Thomas Giorello with colors by Diego Rodriguez. And we'll get into our specific feelings about the art later, but very different look and feel. And not only is the art different in terms of stylistically, but also the way they set up pages, like the panel layouts, is so wildly different between these two artists that I imagine when it's collected in trade, it's going to be a bit jarring. And I didn't really think about that with the couple weeks in between the two issues when I read them. But when I went to look back over the issues before today's episode, it really hit me. It was like, wow, this is, oh yeah, the prelude looks like this because it's Raoul Allen. It's very much Secret Weapons. And the issue 1 looks like this. It's wildly different. And again, it's hard to separate what I know the story was going to be. So originally, I think the story, it was going to be 4 issues rather than 6. There wasn't going to be a prelude. Matt Kent was going to write half with this, probably the same creative team. And then Eric Heiser was going to write the other half of each issue with that same creative team, Raoul Allen and Patricia Martin. So 40 pages, 4 issues each, with each of the writers handling, or creative teams, I should say, handling 20 pages. And so clearly Eric Heiser was going to give us the live wire view. And Matt Kent was going to give us the view of the rest of the universe. That excited me. That was something different. And it was more Eric Heiser on Secret Weapons. So why wouldn't I be excited about that? So when I read this, knowing that it was changed from 4 issues to 6, and now it's just Matt Kent, I can't help but feel a little bit of disappointment for Opportunity Lost. What are your thoughts about it, Jesse?
So I'm going to go two ways on this one. One, I absolutely love Eric's writing. I love and I fell in love with Raul Allen's and Patricia Mann on Wrath of the Eternal Warrior. And initially, I wasn't prepared for them on Wrath of the Eternal Warrior. I was accustomed to the Eternal Warrior with other artists over the years. And then they had a certain style, and it took me a second to kind of connect with it. And then I discovered that they're utter geniuses. And then I even saw that furthermore on it displayed in Secret Weapons. Because it's not just art. The panel layout, it's literally sequential. It's you know, it tells the story without words. And of course, the words are, enhance it. And so I knew coming into, and especially when I read the prelude, that's kind of what this was, that Eric's master plan had been to set Secret Wars up. Use Secret Wars to set up Harbinger Wars 2. And that was going to be, a story told artistically and literary, the way we had seen it going through Secret Wars. I mean, Secret Weapons, sorry. And so I know what's happened. We've got another team involved. We've made a bigger event. We've brought in more artists, more writers playing with it and whatnot. And as a result of that, I love Thomas Chiarello's work. I absolutely do. I mean, his work on Ninja K and his work on Exo Manowar is phenomenal. But it's again, even though I love it to death, it doesn't match the tone of Raul Allen and Patricia Martin. And as a result of that, you're really getting the same story. That's two different stories. You're getting it looks like two different books. It is jarring. It the transition is kind of, it doesn't work. I think if the whole thing was done by either team, it would work. But their art styles and writing styles are just not entirely congruent.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, because like I said, I am disappointed that we're not getting more Eric Heiser. We're not getting that, 20 pages by each team. But sitting here, hearing you talk about it and thinking about it, maybe I wouldn't have liked it as far as art team goes, right? Because then it's going to be, if you read it together as a trade, it would be like, okay, one chapter with this style, one chapter with this style, one chapter back to the original style, one chapter to the later style. It would have been that same disjointedness or I don't know, is jarriness a word, all throughout the story. So maybe it wouldn't work, or maybe it's just the fact that I love Secret Weapons so much, I love the prelude so much, and it's, you're right, it's that sequential storytelling. It's using panel layout and page layout too, and don't give all the credit to the art team on that. Eric Heiser is very aware of the kind of visual storytelling, and he's working in collaboration with Raul Allen and Patricia Martin to make that happen. So when you look at Secret Weapon Zero Owen's story, it's very clear, because it's just two pages for, little two page stories that all tie into a larger narrative, and that's how Eric set it up. So. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. It's so hard for me to separate what I know it was supposed to be from what it actually is. And maybe it's too soon to really say if it's going to be successful to me or not until we get the whole event. And I certainly don't mean to disparage Matt Kent and Thomas Chiarello and that creative team in any way whatsoever, because they are telling a good story. But again, it's hard to forget that this was supposed to be something completely different. And they've, the new team over there at Valiant, based on personnel decisions and issues, from what I understand, had to make the change. And they changed it from something that was unique and that we hadn't really seen before to just kind of a generic event. So I guess the
well, consider this. We both discussed Ninja K. All right, Ninja K is completely drawn, or the first few issues are drawn by Tomas Chiarello. And they're fantastic. They're absolutely fantastic. And again, same thing with Exo Manowar. I mean, some of the best pages. I think he at one point was an Interior Artist of the Year or something. I mean, like, it's incredible work. So he's doing with Harbinger Wars too. He's doing what he does. He's doing what he's supposed to do, which is his art style, which is highly it's strong quality. And Matt Kent is, you know, we've read much of his work, so he's doing what he does too. So, you know, I can't fault either of the guys because they're doing a good job. It's just, you know, they may be the wrong tool for the job that, you know, was intended initially, because they're not the same type of artists. They're not the same type of writers as Eric and Raul. And that creates a circumstance where, you know, you have two quality products, but they're just, you know, sometimes you don't want to have Chinese food and pizza at the same time, you know? I mean, they just don't work well.
Yeah, it's a good analogy. And the other thing is that how much is Matt having to change his story now that he has to tell both sides?
Right.
So, again, it's an unfortunate circumstance, but as Jesse said, they're doing what they have to do. And again, we'll have to reserve judgment for, you know, for after the event is completely finished. But I don't know. I guess it all comes down to, like I said before, it's just disappointment in that I don't get more Eric Heiser, Raul Allen, and Patricia Martin's Secret Weapon, you know, live wire. Because I feel like they have such a great understanding of those characters. So, I mean, some of the best.
It's a management. It's a management and editorial decision is what it looks like.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's for those of our listeners not familiar with that Secret Weapons storyline, because as Jesse mentioned, it does lead directly into this Harbinger Wars event. We probably want to do a quick recap. So do you want to give everybody a rundown of what Secret Weapons was, that four-issue miniseries, Jesse?
Yeah, I'll absolutely do it. A quick rundown is this. There are other PsyOps out there. Not all PsyOps have, like, you know, flamethrower powers or, you know, mind control powers. Some of them have more passive powers or more seemingly ambiguous or unusable powers or powers that may not be of an interest. And those individuals, which were identified by the Harbinger Foundation, by Toyo Harada, you know, they were kind of like, all right, great, we got these guys and we've activated them and they survived the activation process, but they're not really that important or good to us right now. So we're going to shove them off into kind of like a holding pattern or kind of a secret location where they can just kind of like be kind of out of our way. And they're kind of forgotten. And the story really breaks down, you know, the loneliness that goes with that and the frustration and it parallels at the same time the events that transpired throughout Harbinger and Omegas and Imperium and whatnot. And ultimately you have a situation where Livewire becomes a mentor, and a leader for these forgotten PsyOps and kind of a mother figure where she, you know, bands them together and unites them, and they go through a series of events together where they start to learn how to, you know, they learn that they are valuable. They learn that they do have abilities, and they are people, and they have a strong connections, and they have worth. And so she, after several issues and the zero issues, has you know, bonded with a group of people and created a family of sense. That is, not too, unlike, what we saw, in Harbinger with the Renegades, but just a little bit more constrained and a little bit more, with better guidance and direction, almost as if what would have happened with the Harbinger, Renegades had they had better mentorship, better leadership rather than to be left to their own devices. The Secret Weapons ultimately have a path that they can take together and they're growing. And that leads us into, you know, the situation here in Harbinger Wars where, factions, are not necessarily aligned with, the direction, that and the existence of the Secret Weapons that Livewire has been, working to, develop.
Yeah, the other thing we should mention is that when you look at the event, the threads that kind of begin the event or the threads that lead to the event, so to speak, you know, Secret Weapons, I would say, is the direct like prequel or the direct story that leads into the introduction to the characters. And those characters with what happens in the prelude are kind of what jumpstart the war, so to speak. But really the threads for this Harbinger Wars 2 go all the way back to Joshua Dysart's first Harbinger series, because when the Renegades there kind of out Toyo Harada, they let the world know about what his Harbinger Foundation is really doing as far as activating these superpowered beings. Toyo Harada's, you know, an old man who has these incredible psionic powers. That opens a brand new world, right? It opens the door to the general population of the Earth knowing about these superpowered beings that walk among them, that they call Psyots. In the Marvel Universe, they would be mutants. And much like in the Marvel Universe, where mutants are persecuted, rather, we're seeing that here. We're seeing people are scared. People are scared of Psyots. People are worried. You know, they're suspicious of their neighbor or their you know, friends or their coworkers, that they could have these powers and they could not control them, and things could happen. So the government takes it upon themselves to try to police it. The remnants of Project Rising Spirit, which are now known as Omen, they're like offering their services, right? Like we know Project Rising Spirit is a terrible, evil multinational corporation that really has no interest in helping anybody but themselves. So yeah, they're gonna agree to help the government, so to speak. You know, help in quotes there, the government, because really what they want is they want to capture the Psyots and control the Psyots and use them for their own black bag operations. And so, you know, Project Rising Spirit didn't necessarily survive recent events with Bloodshot and everything, but this new Project Omen has kind of risen from the ashes of the Project Rising Spirit, and they're in a position with the government where they're trying to make themselves look a lot more legitimate. They're pointing to any problems that Project Rising Spirit has or had in the past. They're blaming on the previous administration, so to speak. And you know, like, think of it as under new management with a new name, and trying to pull the wool over the eyes of the, you know, legitimate United States government. But really, it's the same old song and dance for them. It's some of the same people that used to be behind the scenes of, like, Kozel, who ran Project Rising Spirit, and now those guys have stepped up to the forefront, and because their resources are so limited now, but they're using that position to fool the government into saying, hey, we're on your side and we're going to help control these Psyots and make sure they don't do any damage. But again, it's like, it's even though these are Psyots, even though these people have superpowers, they're still human, right? I mean, and the people making the decisions are still human, and it's life and it's messy. Things are going to happen. And I can see that side of it as far as trying to prevent tragedy and trying to prevent death. But it goes back to that age-old question: what about the rights of the person being captured, right? What about the rights of? I mean, these people aren't asking to be Psyots. You know, they're not asking for the power. They just so happen to be one of the people that has power. So what's society's obligation to these people? Obviously, society has an obligation to keep its citizens safe, but what about any obligation to those citizens that end up having powers, right? And that's the dichotomy. That's where really Harbinger Wars 2 gets started. That's what it's all about. So to give a quick recap of the prelude, which there's a really great scene. It opens with Livewire walking through the streets and of Los Angeles, I should say, and you can just see she's being overwhelmed by everybody's technology, right? Like, all the noise from people's cell phones and all that. It's just a constant stream. You know, she's kind of got her hand to her forehead, like, God, all this noise. And she walks into a cafe where cell phones are not allowed. Wi-Fi is not there. Laptops not allowed. She sits down, has a cup of coffee, and she's like, or tea, maybe. It looks like maybe it's tea. But anyway, she's like, wow, now I can finally hear myself think. What's interesting is just how powerful Livewire, she's really evolved since she first appeared. I mean, she's got control over anything electronic, and they're really pushing the boundaries of that. I mean, we're talking pacemakers, we're talking, you know, in a split second, she can make a change to the power grid. I mean, it makes sense when you think about how interconnected the world is today. She in my mind, she rivals Harada on power level with being able to control machines and electronics. I mean, that's what makes the world go round. But anyway, while she's in this cafe, she gets recruited, or not recruited, but a guy shows up, Agent Newsom, to bring her in to talk to one of the higher muckety-mucks at Project Omen. And he's looking for the secret weapons, kids. You know, things didn't exactly go well in Secret Weapons as far as the interaction of Avi, Owen, and Nikki, you know, with the police and some other things that happened. And they're wanted. They want to know where they are. And Amanda is protecting them. And they find out, Project Omen finds out where they are, and they send in a kill team, basically. So Amanda's in this room. She's in this meeting and supposedly not able to use her powers. There's psionic dampeners there. But I think it's Axe. I'm not sure why. I thought it was Axe had something to do with it. Who he was one of the psyots that helped out Harada. But he hacks in and gives Amanda the heads up that, hey, they're planning on killing the secret weapons kids. Don't tell them anything. They're not on your side, so to speak, which I think Amanda Livewire kind of knew that already. And so Amanda loses it, right? She's like, enough of the lies. And the guy she's meeting with is like, hey, no spying. We have psionic dampeners in here. How are you even using her powers? And I love this. This is so great. Amanda says, the dampener cycled down for a quarter of a second when the air conditioner kicked on, so I disabled it. Again, that's so powerful. Like in a, you know, split second, the thing powers down while the air conditioner kicks on, and boom, she's got it. It's disabled. So she finds out that her kids are indeed in trouble. There's Charlie Palmer's there, a member of the Hardcore, as well as a kill team. She's able to kind of warn the kids. The kids manage to escape, but again, Amanda has had enough. She's like, if this is how we're going to be treated, this is how you're going to treat kids and attack kids, that's it. I'm done. You know, the fact that you, as a government, have let Project Omen call the shots to deal with this psyot problem or issue or whatever you want to call it, that's it. You know, you've let the bully, you have let the bully believe he's the underdog. You've let the bully take control. The bully being Project Omen. So what she does is she basically says no more, and she's like, you've underestimated my power. She shuts off the United States. Everything's dark. Satellites start falling out of the sky, and that really sets the stage for Harbinger Wars itself. Now, again, this is called Harbinger Wars Prelude, but based on the style and the tone, it really feels so different from the main event, and it's just kind of reinforced by going back through it. But it was an incredible story, an incredible start. I mean, I remember getting my review copy and reading it and just being like, holy crap, this is not what I expected at all from Livewire. I can see where she's coming from, and I can understand it, but I personally feel like it's really a bridge too far. I mean, she's affecting literally millions and millions of people. Some who would be 100% on her side. I think a lot would be 100% on her side if they knew exactly what was going on and how these kids were being hunted, you know, hunted down to be murdered. Because again, I mean, these are the kids from Secret Weapons, who, like Jesse mentioned earlier, have powers that aren't exactly militaristic in nature. You know, these were the abandoned, these were the psyops that Toyo Harada activated and said, oh, well, they have crappy powers. They're useless to me. They're not exactly a danger to society, you know, by being able to turn into stone or talk to birds or summon umbrellas from thin air, right? So the fact that these are the ones that they're going after, you can completely understand why Amanda does what she does. And again, I think that a lot of people would be on Amanda's side if they understood what was going on. But, you know, in the heat of the moment, she makes a choice, and it's an incredible one, and she sends the United States back to the Dark Ages. So, yeah, incredible story. Very, very well done. You have any thoughts specifically about the events of the Prelude, Jesse?
I absolutely do. And there's a couple things I'm going to hit on too. One of them is the symbolism of page one. Now, if you go back to Harbinger in 2012, in the very first issue, actually the cover of the first issue, it shows and depicts Pete Fanchek walking through town, being overwhelmed by his ability to read minds and hearing all the unfiltered thoughts of people around him, and how, it is actually what he ends up doing is taking a lot of painkillers and various mind-numbing agents in order to kind of just cope with life, because he can't handle it. And he is, of course, at the beginning of the 2012 relaunch of Valiant, I mean, he's the man, he's an icon of the series. And here we are, fast forward to 2018, And page one of the Prelude really demonstrates it is now Livewire who is taking front and center stage on that. It is an exact replica of that page in the very first issue of Harbinger, except instead of reading minds, she's reading electronic transmission. She's reading all those communications. And likewise, she is overwhelmed. But unlike Pete, she can cope with it in different ways. She is more mature with it. She is more structured in her ability to handle this situation than apparently he was, because he continues to go through a character evolution to this very day on a path of redemption. Whereas she, on the other hand, is much stronger as a character, much stronger in her personality, and she knows that this is overwhelming, but it is a burden that she is willing to shoulder. It is a burden that she is willing to and able to get to deal with. So I think that's a very impressive symbology, and I wouldn't expect anything less from the creators of Prelude, Raul Allen and Eric. So that's one definite point that I encourage our listeners to go check on, because if you put them side by side, it's the parallel is uncanny. The second thing is. Man, she made a choice, right? She basically shut down the electronics, electrical distribution of the planet. Satellites falling out of space and whatnot. Let's be honest here. There's a couple things that happened. Hospitals shut down. Life support systems shut down. Emergency power grids. Prisons. Cell doors open up. Navigational systems for ships all over the planet taking food to third world countries. Current military operations. All the car crashes that existed, all the bridges that now are, drawbridges that are operating funny. She probably, without realizing, we won't see another pages of the story, but she probably ended up killing several million people in a second just by that action alone and the repercussions that result as from those actions to save a few. So she's making more than just a choice. She's making a hell of a choice. To save, the psyops and the children, in the sense that she's grown to love and nurture, but it's not free. It's certainly not free. There's a massive cost, an unwritten cost that occurs off the pages when you think about it. The world at this exact moment, while ethically it may have to happen in order to do the right thing. There's going to be a fallout, or should be a fallout as a result of these actions, would lead really anybody who's tasked with protecting their people to respond. Because if you were to shut down the electrical distribution systems of the planet right now, it would be catastrophic in ways that we can't even begin to fathom.
Yeah, it's interesting. I just finished reading a book called The Oracle Year by Charles Soule, who writes a lot of comics, but it was his debut novel. It came out in early April. We had Charles on the show recently to talk about it, but there's something that happens in that novel where the power grid from of the world gets shut off, and they specifically address some of the things. And like you said, some of those events, right? Car crashes, drawbridges, military actions, hospitals, and they specifically mentioned people in the middle of life-saving surgeries, right? All of a sudden, I mean, surgery now is so heavily reliant on, you know, computer aid and all these complex systems to help the surgeon do their job. And also specifically, they mentioned in that novel about like scientific research, you know, these research projects that are, you know, at delicate stages that have maybe taken years to get to that point, that it's done, it's ruined. So yeah, there is a huge cost, and it's not a stretch to think that hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people could have been killed in this event. And then that immediately leads me into, I can't help but think about Jean Grey, right? Phoenix. And for those of you listeners who haven't been reading comics a long time or aren't familiar, there's a famous story of the X-Men called the Dark Phoenix Saga, where Jean Grey's Phoenix powers kind of overwhelm her, and she kills a planet, basically, because she can. And there weren't enough consequences in the story that John Byrne and Chris Claremont had planned, at least not in the eyes of editor Jim Shooter. He's like, you can't just have a Marvel character go and kill millions of people, then say, oh, I'm sorry, and kind of have resolution and her keep going, you know, keep being a hero. And that's what ultimately led to the decision to kill Jean Grey, because they did feel there were going to be consequences. So obviously the world has changed. Since then, the world has moved on, and I don't know that we'll see Livewire completely taken off the table. But you have to call it into question, is she a hero at this point? You know, I mean, she's almost like, look at her as the leader of the, you know, of a resistance who's willing to do whatever it takes to change the world. But I don't even think if you were to sit Livewire down and say, hey, here's what you did, here are the consequences, do you think that was a heroic act? I'm sure that the Livewire that we've come to know in the comics would say no, but she would say it was a necessary act. Would you agree with that, Jesse?
I can see her saying that, because she has to make a choice. And I'm going to be honest with you. When you're on the battlefield and you have to make a choice, sometimes you're only presented with bad options, and you have to take, you know, one of the bad options. You know, that's how it is. When I teach my men and women how to, you know, protect or how to defend an objective, one of the things I instill in them is the concept of know your target, but also know what lies beyond your target. Because if you shoot a person or shoot at a person and you shoot through them or beyond them, you're going to possibly hit what's behind them. And that's an unintended consequence, something that, you know, we all know too well watching the news on a daily basis. So you definitely you have to be aware of overshooting your goal. You have to be aware of what lies beyond your target. Otherwise, there will be unintended victims, unintended consequences, and that will compound and may actually work against the goal you're trying to achieve. You know, in doing this, Livewire, what she has essentially done is taken a few people, what would have been a few people that are against her and her secret weapons, and now she's brought a planet against them. And that's, you know, I mean, she's, you know, basically created a, you know, taken a small adversary and now turned it into an entire world against her. And that's a very dangerous place, and it's certainly an unintended consequence.
Yeah, I agree 100%. It's like, and she seems powerful enough to me that she could have been a little more, I don't say diplomatic, but a little more, she could have, it could have been more of a precision strike, right? I mean, she's there in that Omen facility. She can access their computer. She could have like infiltrated their network at that facility and then traveled, you know, followed that network back to all their bases all over the world and just shut down them, right? But I mean, I guess, and again, you know, it's a split second decision. She's acting from emotion as well. But you think maybe she could have even, you know, done just the government or just, you know, she could have done it more surgically so she wouldn't have the main populace turning against her. So, but again, you know,
absolutely,
it's a split second decision running on emotion.
Right, right. And what she could have done, I mean, to be honest with you, is she could have aligned herself with Harada and said, you know, Toyo, I need help. You know, because now she's in the, you know, now she's out here in Africa, you know, in the Federation zone, you know, protecting people. No one can get close to her. No one can harm them, you know, and she's already made a decision, and that is she needs to protect Sayat. So, I don't know. There's a lot of what ifs, and we can always Monday morning quarterback stuff. It just seems like there's a lot of off the page consequences that nobody's seen yet.
Yeah, for sure. And again, it goes back to, I trust Eric Heiser to tell really great stories with Livewire, and now, I mean, I wonder how much he and Matt Kent, as Kent took over that part of the story as well, talked or what notes Kent had to work from. So next time I see Eric, I'll have to pick his brain about that. But anyway, let's move on to issue one. It just came out last week, so I'm just going to kind of gloss over it very briefly, because if you haven't had a chance to read it, obviously I don't want to spoil it for you. So it opens up. We see the aforementioned Pete Stanchek. He's actually traveling around the world as quickly as he can, activating as many psyops as he can, which seems to be a bit counterproductive to me in a way. Like Amanda McKee, Livewire, just shut down the world. Because of psyops, because of people's fear of psyops, ultimately led to Livewire doing what she did. So Pete's answer is to go and activate more. Yeah, not really understanding his motivations there. And he's being pursued by Project Omen, who apparently still have some tech that works. And there's a character by the name of Snowbeard, who I don't remember seeing before, who seems to have a way to track Pete, who that's been a notoriously tough thing to do. Just with the level of Pete's powers at various times. We also see the return to Earth of Arik of Dacia, Exo Manowar, who helps save at least a few satellites from falling out of the sky. And the powers that be at Gate recruit him to go after Livewire, which he doesn't necessarily want to do because he was a member of Unity along with Livewire, considers her a friend and an ally. But when he's confronted with the actual reality of what she did, he reluctantly agrees, and he goes and meets with her, and he's like, you know, you're at war with the whole country. You can't just do what you want, because not only are you putting everybody in danger, that includes Arik people, right? Who are in like Nebraska or somewhere? Who the remnants of the Visigoths that Arik rescued when he got the armor. So he's like, you've gotta stop, right? You need to turn the technology back on, and you got to do it before I have to come after you. So he basically gives her kind of a warning shot, so to speak. They meet, they agree not to fight, and he's giving Amanda to do a chance to do what he feels she needs to do, which is stand down. And then the story continues with when Pete is activating those psyops, not only is he activating their powers, he's also giving them instructions of a place to go and meet where they can be safe. It's called the farm. And we see not only are these newly activated psyops showing up there, but the renegades are there as well, or what's left of them. So Chris, Faith, and Torque. And next we see Ninjak meet with Amanda, not only friends and former allies, but former lovers. So it's much the same as the conversation that Amanda has with or had with Arik, with Exo. Like, you gotta stop because, you know, Pete's flying around the country turning a bunch of kids into ultimate weapons or potential time bombs. He's making everything unsafe. And you've got to get him to stop, and you've got to turn the power back on. And you just, again, you need to stand down because I don't want to have to come after you, Amanda. I care about you. And Bloodshot is there as well. And Amanda's kind of like, you're threatening me with Bloodshot? You know my power is the ability to talk to machines and control them, right? What the heck's Bloodshot going to do to me? Like, that's, I mean, he's a non-starter at this point. So, what's going to happen? That's the question at this point. And Amanda's not going to stand down. She meets up with her secret weapon kids, and she's ready to fight. What exactly she expects or she's fighting for? I mean, I guess I understand what she's fighting for, but I guess the question is, what exactly, like, what's the outcome that she's hoping for here, right? It's another thing that maybe she didn't think all the way through. So there's a lot of action in issue one, but at the same time, there's a lot of setup for action. And I imagine going forward, the last three issues will be pretty action packed because it's Kent's kind of arranging the players on the board, showing where everybody's loyalties lie, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens for sure. But again, my biggest question in my mind is, you know, Amanda McKee Livewire, she's a smart cookie, right? I mean, she knows her stuff. Maybe she acted out of, emotion and, impulsivity in turning off the power, but she's had a chance to think about it now. She has a chance to stand down, and maybe that is the way she should really go, right? Now that she's had time to think about it, maybe turn power on, like restore it from you know, most of the world, and just leave Project Owner without power. But she doesn't want to do that. I think she wants to make a point, right? She's trying to say, what exactly? What does she want? She's just saying, okay, you guys are going to leave Psyots alone forever, and then I'll turn the power back on. I mean, I don't know. That's unclear. That feels like it's a very important and central to the story to understand like what her goal actually is, but we don't really know yet. What do you think, Jesse?
So in a nutshell, I'm going to say this. Harbinger Wars 2 is the Valiant Universe's version of Civil War. You know, you have, you're seeing it here where there's a resistance or a faction, which is Livewire, Secret Weapons, Harbinger Kids, Renegades, versus the establishment. And that's going to be your government contractors and agencies. That's where you're going to have, you know, the tools of the state. I suspect that there's going to be quality arguments made on both sides. However, ultimately, what's going to likely happen, which is often the case in comic books as a whole, is the resistance is really going to be the good guys. So you're going to have you know, Livewire's team, you know, they're really, really good guys. And so as a result, you're going to find guys like, Charlie Palmer are going to be just kind of more blandest tools of the state, the way they're written, you know, where they're just indiscriminately killing and whatnot, not really having any depth of a character or whatnot. And there'll be arguments about safety and protection that will be made to Arik, and I have to make Arik for his people. But that's going to be re-explored. And, of course, there's going to be some sort of a trail at some point. And somebody, likely Ninjak, is going to turn sides. Because I really didn't like the way that the interaction between Ninjak and Livewire went down. I mean, they're basically sleeping together. They love each other. They've been teammates. They know each other and are friends more than anything else. And they're, like, going to have some kind of passive kind of, you know, weird conversation before going their separate ways. No, I don't see that happening. So either one, that was bad writing, or two, it's just out of character because they're not really doing that. They're really just kind of, you know, play both sides of this conflict, and then you're going to jump over and had an opportunity to help her out. I agree with you, man, on why is Pete running around just randomly activating people? I mean, you know, that's like me going around and grabbing, you know, random people and teaching them how to kill and saying, all right, I hope you're good to go now, you know, and then like just walking off. It's a dangerous thing to do. And, you know, you have to be careful with that because not everybody is prepared to handle that responsibly. And you're assuming that you, but like, you know, people in general would have to be assuming by activating folks that they will handle it responsibly, which history shows is not always the case. I'm also wondering why Pete's running around. I mean, why is he running out of Pete? I mean, he's like Harada level, Omega Psiot level, crazy powerful individual who can float off in the rings of Saturn and like sustain himself. Why is he running around like a common criminal trying to like, you know, hide from a helicopter? Yeah. The guy could like, you know, absolutely like engulf himself in an energy sphere and fly around at like the speed of light and devastate, you know, nations. So I'm confused about that portrayal. I mean, it looks like it's not even Pete. I mean, it might as well be a whole different character. You know, hey, I better run away from the spotlight that's on me from this helicopter. Whereas if that was Toyo Harada, who has the same exact ability, he would just look at him and like implode them into a tin can. I'm a little confused with that portrayal. It doesn't really make sense to me at all. I would compare it to, Dead Drop Issue 1 when Exo Manowar was running around on the streets of New York, which also didn't make sense. And lastly, the end game, as you said, I mean, it's one of the worst and most difficult problems of going to war with anybody isn't actually going to war. It's not actually fighting either. It's what do you want the desired end state to be so that this can resolve itself? Because it's easy to drop bombs on people. It's easy to shoot them. It's easy to run around and, you know, topple government. It's a very, very difficult thing to bring it all into a close and tie a nice bow around it and say, hey, here's the new world. And so while Livewire may be in a situation where she is able to resist and she is able to protect, and she is able to affect change, unless she has some kind of, you know, new regime she can install, or unless she has some kind of safe zone that she can build where she is able to have diplomatic immunity and let people live in peace, or unless she is able to do something to that effect, I don't know how smart she is. I'm not entirely sure that there is an end game. Right now it may just be a knee jerk reaction. You know, like we have to do something. We have to do it right now. Crap. This is what we're going to do. I hope this works. And that's a dangerous, strategic place to be in because there is no strategy. The strategy is really survive. And that's not really very good for a very long time. That's more of a short-term strategy at best.
Yeah, I agree. It's like, what do you need to have happen, Amanda, in order to stop fighting, in order to turn the power back on? And even if they tell you exactly what you want to hear, like you've shown that you don't believe them and you don't trust them, so it doesn't really seem like they're – you know, really is a resolution. But I agree with you in that this is definitely Valiant's version of Civil War, right? But I do feel like in that, the resolution, what the heroes on Captain America's side wanted was much more clear, right? They didn't want to sign up and let the government know their secret identities. So their end goal was much more clear, I suppose, where here it's not. And the other thing that I'll mention or touch on that you talked about is, yeah, the character interaction. It just doesn't necessarily ring true. I didn't think about Pete running around, but now that you mention it, I don't know how I did miss it. Like, what? Yeah, why is he? I mean, and we've seen him in and Toyo Harada, both in Harbinger and Imperium, you know, show that they could fly like, you know, ridiculously fast. And yeah, so why is he running around? Yeah, you're right. That doesn't make any sense. I don't know. Maybe Pete is still self-medicating and is affecting his powers. I don't know. Not sure. But yeah, going back to the character interaction, I just don't see Ninjak being on the side of, especially because the guy basically works for money, which in my mind for him is always an excuse to fight on the side of angels, without letting people know that he really is a hero. It's kind of a way that he insulates himself. But being that, that he's basically a hired gun, why would he possibly take money to fight against against Livewire? So you're right. I could totally see him flipping sides. But, you know, for the most part, the heroes of the Valiant universe, the characters of the Valiant universe that we've come to know, I feel like most of them would side with Livewire. So it's kind of tough to see them, you know, be kind of these bumbling dunderheads that are the pawns of Project Omen and are going to, you know, go against Livewire and fight against her. So, I mean, I guess hardcore, because technically Project Omen runs them. That's how they get their powers. So I could see that. But anybody else, I can't see it. And if anybody can live in this brave new world that Amanda's created without electricity, it would be the Visigoths. So I don't know why Eric would be worried about his people anyway. If anybody's used to living without technology, it would be them, right? I mean, they actually are maybe better off than the majority of the population, because they actually have experience living before all this technology. So it's going to be interesting for sure, and I think that we're set up for a lot of action going forward. We did talk a little bit about the art, more so about the art in the Prelude with Raoul Allen and Patricia Martin. And I'm just going to touch briefly on Thomas Giorello's art. I enjoy his art. I don't think it's quite as clean here as I've seen it be in the past. There are times when I feel like his characters look a little bit stocky, like a little shorter and stockier than I'm used to seeing, specifically Pete. I think you kind of alluded to that, Jesse. And the other thing about his art, and I don't know, maybe this is goes to Diego Rodriguez. So I'm used to big events being a little more in your face in terms of color. And I don't know that Thomas's art is ever really colored, where it's a bit more primary, a bit more, I don't know, for lack of a better term, comic booky. But the colors here are very muted, and I feel like that affects the tone of the story a bit. And it's not to say that the colors need to be like super, super bright, because if you look at the Prelude issue with Patricia Martin's colors, those aren't really bright colors either, but it's a different style of coloring. It doesn't look quite so like painted or watercolor, and I feel that it works a little better. Here, the colors are so subdued that I feel like it loses some of the impact. Because again, I think for comic book events, having something, you know, bright and bold helps to make it feel more impactful, which in turn makes it feel more of consequence, which, you know, is what you kind of want from a big event. So it's a minor quibble for sure. I certainly can't fault Giorello's storytelling. I think his storytelling is really good. And I enjoy his art overall, but there's just a few, you know, we haven't really seen his take on a lot of these characters before. We haven't seen him draw Pete Stanchek. We haven't seen him draw, you know, obviously some of the Project Rising Spirit people. I've seen him draw Exo before, but I can't recall him ever drawing like Faith or Torque or Chris Hathaway. So, you know, it's artistic license for sure. Not every artist is going to draw every character exactly the same. And other than Pete, who, you know, isn't the most recognizable because he never has a costume on, I think everybody else is pretty recognizable as who they are. But if I could change anything about the art, it would be the color. But that being said, I don't know that Thomas's art is the kind of art that would look right with that kind of color. It might look kind of weird. So I don't know, maybe he wasn't the best choice to draw this. It's an interesting thing to think about. You have anything else to add about the art, Jesse?
let's think about that. You get a lot of vibrant colors when you're dealing with an artist like Clayton Henry, for example, who's got very, very clean lines. Yeah, it gives he almost draws like a coloring book in a sense, you know, where colors can do so much.
Yeah.
Whereas Giorello, and I own a couple of Giorello's pieces of art, and he works almost exclusively with pencil, and it's very sharp, very clean. But he uses a lot of hatching and cross hatching, and you know, a lot of shading and whatnot. And you got to go in there and color that, I imagine, digitally, and you know, without taking away from the lines, you know, there's only so much you can do with it. So it's also got kind of a cartoonish, but like a certain amount of realism to it. So I can only expect that you're going to get skin tones that are going to be more natural in appearance. I think that Diego Rodriguez goes for seemingly natural and subdued tones and palette. You know, we saw an Exo Manowar, you know, out in outer space and whatnot, where he certainly was expanding his colors palette a little bit because of, you know, some of the solar and lens flare coming off of you know, the multiple suns and whatnot. I like it. I don't know that his art, the Giorello's art style, would work well with really vibrant colors. Whereas I can tell you that Raoul Allen certainly can. Of course, he's been working with Patricia Mann for a while too. I mean, Martin for a while as well. So, they just got their own unique look and style to them. As I said at the beginning, I wouldn't have minded seeing the entire Harbinger Wars 2 story drawn by Raoul Allen. Nor would I have minded seeing the entire thing done by Giorello. I just don't really want to see it done by both.
Right.
And I can go back to Harbinger Wars 1, which was a mixture, as you may recall, of Clayton Henry, who had that very, very professional house style of comic book art. But you also had Clayton Crane, who has, you know, literally everything's digitally painted. And they're both phenomenal, but not even remotely the same. And you end up having to you're put you in a place where you start wondering which one you like more, which one would be better. Which one is better for the story? And very similar. The answer is both. Both are better for the story. I'm not really typically a big fan of mixing artists, especially on a big book. I kind of would have liked to have seen Raoul Allen and Chris Martin start and finish this book.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. Again, it's no knock against Thomas Giorello. I just feel like his art style isn't, because again, I think you're 100% correct. He's got so much shading and hatching, and I don't think his art would necessarily look good with bold colors. So he may not have been the you know, the right choice. I mean, he 100% is the right choice. I loved what he did on Ninja K. That's more of a street level story, right? On a street level character. And mm-hmm. And not to say he can only draw street level characters, because he did, you know, a ton of issues of Exo Manowar set in space that were incredible as well. But yeah, he just may not have been the best choice for this story. Not to say the art's bad, but again, I just love the storytelling from panel to panel that Allen and Martin use, and to see a whole story in that style, a big event, an impactful event in that style, I think would have been really cool. All right. Anything else we want to say about Harbinger Wars 2?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm still, the jury's still out on this one. I'm gonna read it start to finish. I hope, and they've already said that it's going to set the stage for the next phase of Valiant Comics. So I don't anticipate a soft eventless resolution. I suspect that it's going to be. That'd be huge. I suspect that the repercussions from this storyline, once it's all said and done, are going to result in as they said, Diane said, the way ahead. So there may be, you know, some new international boundaries drawn. There may be some new deaths. There may be some, you know, new significant events that, you know, similar to the attack on Mexico City, will vibrate through the Valiant universe for years to come. This is the first major event that has happened since the new management, as such, I would not be shocked to see if any new directions that are taken are in the aftermath of the events that are unfolding in Harbinger Wars 2.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be interesting. You know, we talked a lot about the changes to the event itself. And I imagine there have to be changes in the aftermath as well, because, you know, there's different people calling the shots over there now. Not to say it's going to be worse or better, just different. So I think a lot of Valiant fans were looking at this as kind of the last hurrah of the old regime, because it was, you know, something they had planned. And they're really looking to what comes next as a barometer for what to expect from the new team. So it's going to be very important for the new team over there at Valiant to be sure that whatever comes after Harbinger Wars 2, it lives up to that same level of quality that we've come to expect. So once again, I want to thank everyone for joining us. Don't forget, you can go to lrmonline.com for all past episodes of the podcast. Twitter.com/thecomicsource is where we can be found on Twitter. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three places are great spots to follow along with our convention coverage and find out when we release new episodes. Quick reminder, I'll be at Denver Comic Con the 15th, 16th, and 17th of this month. Track me down if you're there. Hit me up on Twitter. Come and find me. Get your free Comic Source lanyard. I always love to meet listeners. So thanks for joining, and we'll talk to you next time.